From theunce.com, this is the Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to the Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. Today we bring you my full interview with Lauren Ashton, aka Bass Nectar. This phenomenally popular DJ and producer has been in the game for more than a decade, and it's practically impossible to recap his entire career in a few sentences, so let's just run down the past year. He headlined some of the biggest festivals in the country, including Sasquatch, Summer Camp, Electric Forest, Starscape, Nocturnal, North Coast, and many, many more, threw down two huge nights with Pretty Lights in Georgia, and released a brand spanking new album, Divergent Spectrum, on Amorphous Music. He's responsible, in great part, for popularizing dubstep in the United States, and this New Year's, he's going all out with a sold-out performance at Nashville's Bridgestone Arena for more than 10,000 rabid fans ready to lose their shit. Enough build-up? I thought so. Let's get to the interview. So, you headlined several festivals this past summer. Your club and theater shows sell out within minutes. Your free downloads crash servers left and right. But you're doing this without any major industry support. You're not on Ultra Records. You don't get airplay. You're not from New Jersey, so you can't get on MTV. It's funny your roots lie in Northern California because you're essentially the DJ equivalent of the Grateful Dead.
Wow, that is quite a statement. Yeah, you know, I can't say really that I was just talking to someone else and he was saying, you know, your music is indescribable because it contains so many different factors and that must be a real challenge in marketing. And I was thinking to myself that, you know, that doesn't really concern me and it isn't really something that I would want to change to make my music more describable so that it could be more marketable. I just think that marketing my music is something that happened pretty organically, and it happened over a long, long period of time, well over a decade, at a cost of an enormous amount of work, and it's been a huge group effort. And I think that's what's most special to me about the project in general, is that it is something that's lasted through the years and it's built upon itself and changed dramatically and consistently mutated and morphed, and it is a massive collaboration, and it's a huge, you know, lifelong art project for me that the face keeps changing, but it's a big part of me, and it's something that I love to share. In fact, by definition, it is something I have created in association with other people to share and to bring about effective, positive change in other people's lives on an emotional level. So I'm really happy with where things are at and excited to see where they're going, but I also... marketing it isn't as important to me as maybe it should be, because at the end of the day, I don't care about looking cool or having shades or the right style, or I feel like I'm kind of a funny looking guy, and thank goodness I can hide behind my hair. And I'm happy. I'm happy. I'm not so short. I'm just saying it's not my focus. My focus isn't how badass can I be. My focus is to create something special and to share it.
And along those lines, you made so many dreams come true when you announced those two Alpharetta dates in mid-October featuring yourself from Pretty Lights. Derek Smith has that whole Rocky Mountain vibe with lush melodies, vocal samples, and hip-hop beats. You come from the rough and tumble West Coast scene of big bad bass. Is there a middle ground? And obviously there is, because of, you know, that huge groundswell of fan support. Tell me you secretly worked on this EP over those 2 days, and its release will signal the end of the world.
That was a pleasure to do that, and it felt overdue, and we were hanging out and kind of, you know, let down with ourselves that we didn't make the EP, because it had been a plan. You know, as soon as we officialized the dates, we were on the phone just being like, yeah, we should do this, and we should do that, and we should do this, and in the blink of an eye, you know, 4 months passed, and there we were. And
sure.
It's so hard to be on the road and creating at the same time, and for myself, you know, I spend just as much time working on music as I do creating the events. You know, I'm as an art form, creating events is an obsession of mine, and mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with every last detail of each person's experience. And it isn't something where I just want to walk into a venue and play a DJ set. It's I want to think about every person walking into the venue, and you know how complete and powerful their experience can be, both in a mixture of safety and feeling included and encouraged to you know explore things within themselves, and also just to go buck fucking wild. And that's why I kind of liken it to both a rave and a death metal show combined. Because it's a balance of that utterly filthy and utterly beautiful, or at least what I consider to be that, and combining the two in different ways.
As evidenced by your wildly successful Bass Centers and Bass Island, which, as you put it, it is an art project, because I had no idea that you were thinking about every last piece of crazy ultraviolet silly string or tinsel hanging from the hallway as the ferry reaches the island. But I imagine, you know, you had so much control over your music and your image and all that, so obviously it makes sense that you would be in charge of not only picking the artist for the bill, but also creating that experience with your massive, deeply devoted team, as well as the ambassadors and all of that.
Yeah, man, it's a balance of the fact that everything is a group effort, and I'm committed to that. I love collaboration. I love working with people, but I'm also a total control freak. So, you know, there's those two just go hand in hand in Bass Nectar Land. But, you know, I got my start, you know, musically, immediately playing in a band, as a very crude band, and at the exact same time wanting to throw events, and was throwing death metal shows in this Cupertino library basement that a lot of punk rock and grindcore shows were happening at. And it was a very do-it-yourself style environment with, you know, the white lights on the ceiling and a carpeted floor and no stage, and, you know, no more than 100 people could fit in. And the most hardcore shows that I've ever seen happened in that basement, from, you know, the bloodiest, you know, exhumed playing with maggots, live maggots spraying over the crowd, and
nice.
Horrible fucking mosh pits, to, you know, wild, jubilant, almost punk rock music. And, you know, I was 16 at the time throwing shows there, and I was 19 and 20, you know, driving around from warehouse to warehouse in San Francisco saying, like, hi, I'm Lauren Ashton. I work with a drum circle collective, and we play loud drum circles, and we'd like to rent your yoga studio for an all-night drum circle. And then, of course, you know, bringing in a sound system and throwing in an illegal rave,
sure.
to driving around through the beaches and forests in Santa Cruz, and, you know, finding the perfect little grove in a forest that's miles away from the last telephone pole, and lugging a sound system with my buddies and putting up directions on a voicemail, and everyone, you know, shows up, and you got 500 people dancing into the sunrise. Those are the kind of things that really formed what I'm doing today. They weren't about money. It wasn't commercial. It was just totally for the love. And what I'm doing today is totally for the love. And the fact that it's commercial is kind of a necessary evil, partly because most of the venues and the ways to collect those humans and avoid power outages and the cops shutting things down and keep everything safe happens in, you know, large commercialized venues, which I find so ugly. But, you know, as long as I can transform them as best as possible and let each human come in and feel as like they are as unmarketed to as possible, try and cover up the beer signs, try and cover up the logos, try and give them free water, try and encourage a friendly atmosphere, and not, you know, it's a little awkward for me being up on a massive stage, and so try and separate that kind of ego from, you know, everyone gather and be in awe of a performer, and more like everyone gather together and have a unified experience. I'm just really legitimately interested in redefining that group experience from a rock concert, and using the kind of the facelessness that I felt at raves, where everyone was just focused on each other and themselves, and kind of more inward and outward at the same time. 'Cause I never really appreciated going to concerts. It wasn't something I liked doing. I know a lot of my fan base comes from, you know, more of a live band, live concert atmosphere, and it was always something that
sure.
I felt lacked a certain personality, because I didn't want to stand there and stare at five people or one person on stage, you know, unless they were levitating. So for me, you know, we try and as much as possible make each seat or space in the venue sound and feel as if you're standing right in front of the speakers, and there's a just abhorrent amount of work that's been going into creating that experience for people. And I think this is perhaps the longest sentence I've ever spoken, so I apologize if I bored you with that.
No, that there's a lot to unpack there, and I'd like to do it. If you catch your breath, and I will provide you some more fodder. I'm glad you mentioned being a control freak, because I'm worried about your collaborative process. Working with Excision, Datsik, Ill Gates, Freak Nasty, your signature sound doesn't always permeate the track. They actually sound fully collaborative. But I still wonder, do you try your best to, when you go into the studio to work with someone, or you're trading files over the internet, do you do your best to remove all ego from the equation and tell your collaborator that you just want to make a sick track and there's nothing to prove?
I don't even think like that. And frankly, I don't even think necessarily that I have a signature sound. I know that, you know, I can tell right away what I like and what I don't like. And collaboration for me is, it's such an interpersonal experience, you know, with Freak Nasty, we spend more time talking about his Tibetan Buddhism than anything. And with Dylan, Ill Gates, we just geek the fuck out about quantum physics and ludicrous inside jokes. And it's just kind of a way of hanging out. With Datsik and Excision, it's like I'm up in Canada on tour once a year in the winter, and I'm kicking it over at Datsik's house, and his mom's making a soup, and we're like just straight geeking out. And it's just fun. A lot of times, you know, we can make it as easy as let's remix one of my songs, let's remix one of your songs, and see where that goes. Or, you know, you can just set the intention in any way. I want to make a fucking huge, mesmerizing, melodic roller that can be played in a stadium. Or I want to make something so twisted and ugly, but at just, you know, the moment, the breaking point when half of the listening audience would want to turn it off because it's so filthy, I wanted to switch right there and, you know, drop into this, you know, very familiar reggae song or whatever the heck it is. You know, it's a hard process to really adequately describe unless you're there.
I imagine.
But it's more interesting to me than making music alone, partly because I have so many conflicting interests and I'm so fucking busy and distracted and overwhelmed with just, you know, being on the road and whatever, that I literally have, I used to say I have hundreds of unfinished songs, and now it's thousands. And it's, wow, it's almost unpleasant when I sit down to work on a song, just trying to stay focused on that one song without opening up three more computers and opening up three more songs and trying to, like, swap samples and move things around and combine tunes. And it's just like having someone step in who can help rein you in. It's like, every good book has a book editor, you know what I mean? And
absolutely.
And some of the times it's more fun to focus on one thing or the other. Like if you're making a really percussive track, you might have more fun making the drum beats and the melodies. And another song, you might want to get all technical. I've worked with people who are very poor at mixing down a song, but are amazing with creative ideas. And in that situation, I might want to lend a hand in the more technical aspect of polishing the song, but then I work with people who are absolute geniuses at mixing down, and at that point, why do I want to focus on the mix down? I'd rather focus on this intense breakdown here, or maybe adding melodies, or maybe, you know, cutting up a vocal, or it's just kind of like a give and take, an interplay that I find addictive. We'll be right back.
Divergent Spectrum, produced by Bass Nectar with Jansen.
I wonder if you feel like a curator of great music. Your fans listen to your various samples and remixes and then trace them back to their roots. Oh, I love Prince. I guess I'll see what these Deftones are all about. Or I love Where Is My Mind. Who are these Pixies? I'll have to assume half your audience was still in diapers when Surfer Rosa came out.
Yeah, you know, I think that I'm definitely from a band background.
Mm-hmm.
Writing music was something that I learned how to do in the context of being in a band. And producing electronic music was something that I learned how to do by myself in a room with full of gear and then in school. But being a DJ is a whole other thing, and I'm very much a DJ as well. A DJ is a collage artist. And at the end of the day, DJing is as simple as, I love this song and I want to play it for someone else. It's that simple. And it can get much more complex on, you know, any direction. If it's hip-hop, how good at scratching are you? If it's beat matching, how good are you at keeping two records matched? If it's Ableton, what do you do with different layers and, you know, the crazy mixes that would be impossible on turntables? And
sure,
if it's live, you know, it's how many boxes can I wire together? And there's all these different things. But for me, DJing had a lot to do with kind of more of a Jamaican sensibility of selecting a song.
Selecting
the right tune for that one fucking moment. There's a million songs you can play, but you're going to play this one. And it may not be the newest song. It may not be the coolest, freshest song, but it is the best song. It's the one that makes everyone get goosebumps, or it's the one that, you know, or maybe it isn't. Maybe it's the one that terrorizes everyone and kind of pulls them out of their trance for a second, so when you drop the next track on them, the impact is that much more intense. And really kind of constructing the flow almost like a comic would construct a stand-up comedian, a stand-up comedy routine.
Sure.
So, you know, I take a lot of pleasure in selecting samples. I take a lot of pleasure in combining influences. And I'd be the first to admit that everything I've ever created, thought, said, or done is a reflection from other people. I don't believe I've ever had an inherently original thought. And if I have, it certainly wasn't the first time someone else had thought the exact same thing. And I'm not really concerned about that. It's, what I like doing is just humbly reflecting things. So, you know, hearing someone make a death metal song or a Norwegian black metal song and being inspired by that melody, but taking that melody out and playing it through a synthesizer, and then hearing a fucking house track and being inspired by the electronic drums, the way that they build, but not liking the beat. So being inspired by the beat from something else and whatever it is, and then you're alone in the studio with a million options, I really feel like that is, it's been a gift for me to be able to have done this for so long and have such a vast record collection of references, to be able to turn on people to music that, you know, to me was so emotionally influential, whether it's, you know, the Pixies and Metallica, or whether it's, you know, much older and more rare forms of music.
Have you ever encountered a track that's just off limits to you? Either you can't figure out how to remix it, or it just doesn't work, or you can't touch it because a rehashing would be sacrilege and it couldn't hold a candle to the original.
I don't feel it's a sacrilege, but I do feel that there's a lot that just doesn't work, doesn't flow. There's a lot that, I really try and work with what comes the most natural. And, you know, I was just talking yesterday about the remix of Ellie Goulding, how I did that in one day. And literally, I was on YouTube listening to dubstep remixes of Ellie Goulding, and I'd never listened to an Ellie Goulding song. And I kept hearing all these mixes that would build up with her vocals and then smash into the most profane and absurd and quite good dubstep drops, just full-on bass carnage.
I'm sure you made a lot of people's days there, right there.
Well, I love bass carnage, but I also didn't want to hear that. My ear wanted to just hear her voice continue, but be ultimately reinforced. And so, you know, after listening to a bunch of these remixes, I just got her version, her song called Lights, which is just a stereo mix, and did a remix in a day just so that I could have it to play. I was working last January on creating new materials for the winter tour. Mm-hmm. And that's all it was. It was just a one day spent in the studio making a remix to play live. And when we gave it away, we had over 250,000 people download it for free, and to the point that she then wanted to sell it on her, you know, release. And so she sold it And then we put it on Divergent Spectrum, and it was the top-selling song on Divergent Spectrum, and it just continues to spread. And that was all just from one day tooling around with a song that just came instantaneously because she's so good. She's that good. So I prefer to wrestle less because there is such limited time. I'd like to work with the stuff that just comes instantaneously where that flow is natural.
I had a way then, losing it all on my own. I had a heart then, but the queen has been overthrown. And I'm not sleeping now, the dark is too hard to beat. And I'm not keeping now, the strength I need to push me.
Let's get away from music for a second. You grew up in a commune. You've got very egalitarian roots. You say you're all about community. I wonder if that's why you're so politically aware and care deeply about social causes. I know you worked closely with Conscious Alliance and Freak Nasty's GiveBack.net for Tibet. You released your remix of the Bangles' Walk Like an Egyptian when Hosni Mubarak's regime was toppled. You've shown love for the Occupy movement, among others. I mean, what's preventing you from running for office, you know, when your bones are too brittle to break them knees on the dance floor?
I don't know. I'm not interested in politics anymore, for better or for worse. I was, during the Bush administration, I really did have my eyes opened on September 11th. Before that, I was just not that aware or concerned. And if I thought about politics, I thought about the Bill Clinton sex scandal and just didn't really care. And I recognize that for the most part, Republican politicians support a very rich, select elite and corporate base of humans. And for the most part, Democratic politicians support a wider base of American citizens. And of course, there's corrupt officials in both. But I understood that, and so I voted Democratic for most of the time up until that point because it was just like, well, I think I'm not concerned about rich people. I think, you know, everyone should have a fair share. This is a democracy, et cetera. And when September 11th happened, I started getting behind the scenes and understanding who Dick Cheney was and the companies that he had worked for before and that those were the main companies supporting the Iraq War or making money off the Iraq War, and understanding that he had met with energy officials and Enron and other, you know, multi-billion dollar international corporations before he became vice president. With what was called the Secret Energy Task Force, which to this day has not been made public, I started realizing like there's serious shit going on, and the reason it's important to know about is because we are one of the most, if not the most, wealthy and influential countries in the world, and what we do as citizens, in a large part, can affect the lives of so many other people that I just started to feel a responsibility for getting educated. But as I got educated, I found out that there was a lot of inconvenient truths. There was a lot of things that it's almost nicer to not know about. Mm-hmm. And I think that a mixture of just basic intelligence with basic empathy, learning facts and understanding truths or information, if not truths, and then caring about it and caring about other people kind of led me to try and get as involved as I could. But these days, I see politics as just such a stupid circus and such a distraction from the real issues at hand. And for me, I feel like I can make more of an impact by focusing on a humanistic level and encouraging people to become educated and to be inspired to give back and to think more critically and to get more involved with their communities on a local level. And I'm excited to reflect the things which excite me. And in this case, and for now, until further notice, I'm just really happy doing it from a more humanistic level than a political one.
And you've given so much money back to charity. I encourage all listeners to look into the dollar per base head fund. Get yourself educated, obviously. We got to wrap things up, so let me bring it back to music to close out. I got to know, why Nashville? I know it's Music City, USA, but there's I wonder if there's a deeper significance to ringing in 2012, quite possibly our last year on this planet in Nashville.
It flowed naturally. Basically, we had insane turnout in Nashville last September 2010, where we were playing at a venue with a capacity of 1,500, and somehow someone had left the tickets on sale past their sellout. So pretty soon we'd sold like 3,000 tickets, and it was like months away from the show, and we were just like, where can we move this? And we moved it to the parking lot and ended up selling, you know, almost 5,000 tickets, and it was spilling out into the streets. And it was such a fucking beautiful fiasco that we knew we had to come back and do something special, but we didn't know what it was, and we were looking at different options. But, you know, we had just played Atlanta with Derek, and we have certain Red Rocks plans with Colorado, and there are just different places that we might have done New York, but we'd already done Bass Island, and so Nashville was just kind of sitting there. And sure enough, you know, we've within 2 weeks, I think, sold out 10,000 tickets. So it feels like the right choice. And at this point, my crew and I we're like giddy school children, or maybe not school children, giddy school children who have just been released from school, I guess. We're hyped. We're spending a lot of time planning this one out.
Well, it's going to be a fantastic blowout. Lauren Ashton, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for coming on for this, the 100th episode of the Unz Podcast. It really means a lot to us.
Yeah, congratulations. I actually, I don't know how this is going to sound, so you can edit it out if it doesn't work, but that's a little key patch here. Hang on a minute.
Oh.
Yeah, so that's your happy birthday.
I can't thank you enough for that. Well, Lauren, again, thank you so much for being on the Unz Podcast.
Yeah, much love.
That's going to do it for this week's show. Special thanks go to my guest, Lauren Ashton. You can catch Bass Nectar at the end of the month in South Lake Tahoe for the inaugural Snow Globe Festival. Then he scrambles to Nashville the next night for his big New Year's blowout at the Bridgestone Arena before heading down under for a few dates in January. More info at bassnectar.net. And of course, a big thank you goes out to friends, family, and the Unz staff for making this show possible. And you, the fans. Win tickets to the Unz.com second anniversary show at Temple in San Francisco on Friday, December 16th, featuring Nit Grit, DNA Beats, Freddie Todd, Gold Rush, and more. You can also win tickets to see Zed's Dead in Milwaukee, Tipper in Cambridge, Mass., and Ill Gates and RD in San Diego by visiting the Unz.com/contests. Please visit the Unz.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review. Tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the Unz Podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunz.com. Join the conversation at the Unz Podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.